on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, China puts a cap on the amount of Australian beef it will take this year.
Yeah, so Australia has been allocated about 200,000 tonnes of access into the market. That will be tariff-free. But once we trigger that volume, we'll have to pay a 55% tariff, which will be prohibitive.
And the winery bridging the north-south gap in Tasmania.
Yeah, so we own a vineyard at the very far north of the Tamar. So we're the northernmost vineyard on the west side of the Tamar River at a little place called Yorktown, just north of Beaconsfield. Then we lease an old vineyard just past Sorel on the Arthur Highway.
Yeah, one of the many wineries serving customers at this year's Taste of Summer, with vineyards covering the north and the south of the state. Their story coming up on this first day of 2026. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you, and may this be your year to remember. Have a great one. It will become the Chinese Year of the Fire Horse from the middle of next month. And China has fired up the export debate around beef by imposing a 55% tariff on amounts of Australian beef above 200,000 tonnes. Details of that story coming up in just a moment. How's your garlic growing this year? Smaller bulbs? Some rust, maybe? We'll talk to a southern Tasmanian garlic grower who says it's the worst season since he began growing the precious bulbs because of the weather and also rust. Talking about the weather, we'll have a full rundown of what to expect in around about 10 minutes from now. And you can stay in touch with us via that text line. 0438 922 936 is that number. China's Ministry of Commerce has today slapped a 55% tariff on any Australian beef over and above an existing quota of 200,000 tonnes per year. Australian Meat Industry Council Chief Executive Officer Tim Ryan says these new restrictive trade arrangements imposed on Australia are not fair or appropriate and fly in the face of the long-standing mutually beneficial trade relationship Australia has with China. He says Australian beef is high quality, safe and sustainably produced. It accounted for just 8% of China's overall beef imports in 2024. Nearly 80% of beef imported into China comes from South America. Tim Ryan says the meat industry and trade officials will continue to negotiate to try and gain an exemption.
Yeah, it certainly is a disappointing outcome to hear the news overnight. China's effectively decided to implement a regime of import quotas to supplying nations such as Australia. This will ultimately limit the volume of beef we can ship into the market in 2026 and over the next 3 years.
And it's about the amount of beef over an existing quota. So why is that a problem?
Yeah, so Australia has been allocated about 200,000 tonnes of access into the market. That will be tariff-free. But once we trigger that volume, we'll have to pay a 55% tariff, which will be prohibitive going forward. So effectively, it means a 200,000-tonne cap on what we can trade. If you compare that to recent trade performance over the last 12 months, we've shipped over a little bit over 300,000 tonnes. So we're kind of going or losing about a third of our current trade into China.
And what will this mean in terms of where China gets their beef from? Are they going to get it from South America?
Yeah, and South America is certainly the dominant player in the market. About 80% of beef currently imported into China comes from South America. We account for about 8%. So we certainly are a minor player, but we play an important role, and particularly from our side, China's very important for us. It's currently our second largest export market, taking around 17% of our overall exports.
And is there any way of getting around this, or might they change their mind? Because, I mean, I understand Australian beef is very popular in China.
Yeah, and that's the case we've been making throughout this year-long investigation China's been through. The decision they've taken is in response to the domestic industry lobbying that they've been affected by imports. We've pushed strongly that Australia hasn't necessarily been the cause of any damage to their domestic industry. And as you say, our beef is extremely popular. Chinese consumers have developed a long preference for Australian beef. We've been in the market for a very long time and would like to continue to do so. Ultimately, once we hit our quota allocation for the year, we'll have to re-divert that trade elsewhere.
And I've been to China and I've seen the domestic product versus the Australian product, and this, you're not comparing apples with apples, are you, with the quality-wise?
No, certainly not. And we play an important role in the market, and particularly some of those premium segments. The type of beef we produce is quite different. We can do grain and grass and chilled and frozen, and we ultimately complement the domestic industry. We are, at the end of the day, a drop in the ocean in the overall meat complex in China.
Now, you put a dollar figure on this of potentially a $1 billion hit to the industry. How do you get to that figure?
Yes, certainly. If you look at that recent trade performance, so the last 12 months we've done about 300,000 tonnes. We'll have to go back to around 200,000 tonnes this year based on these quota restrictions. If you put a value on that amount of tonnage, it's a bit over $1 billion. So that trade will have
per annum.
So that trade will then be redirected to alternative export markets, and some of it come back to the domestic market as well.
But you may not get the premium price for it if you send it to Southeast Asia, for example.
And that's certainly the important role China plays in our overall export portfolio. So we'll always be able to sell our beef, and the world loves our beef, but the next best option to China won't necessarily pay the same price.
So are we going to see a reduction in the price for cattle at the sale yards, or that's a long bow?
It's difficult to anticipate how markets will react, and certainly immediately we'll continue to trade with China. This market's not going to disappear, certainly not in the short term. And when we hit quota, that's probably going to be mid-year in 6 or 7 months' time. But there's a lot of other factors that impact price, and this is one of many. But certainly if you see our second largest beef export market dry up at some point in 2026, it will feed through to that pricing complex.
So where to from here? I mean, are we going to get the trade experts out and talking to China again, or maybe change the regulations or special dispensation for Australian beef maybe in China?
Yeah, we'll certainly continue to push for that. That's been the case that we've made at an industry and government level throughout this investigation over the last 12 months, and asked for special treatment at the end of the day. We don't think we're the problem, so we don't think we necessarily need to be captured by these new trade measures.
And we can't just sort of send more beef into the US, for example?
We'll probably do some of that. The US market is very strong at the moment. You can always sell into the US trim market, but it's the premiums you lose along the way in rediverting those cuts. So we're never going to be short of a buyer. We sell into over 100 export markets around the world. The challenge is the value that is lost when you have to redirect trade.
What's happening with the EU then? Is that a possible market we could ship some of this excess beef into out of China?
We would love to do more trade into the EU, and there's currently the FTA negotiations that are underway at the moment. So this just really reinforces the need for good access into as many markets as possible. And I think it really highlights the fact that we need a really good outcome for beef and all red meat in these current EU negotiations underway at the moment.
Australian Meat Industry Council Chief Executive Officer Tim Ryan talking to Michael Condon about a 55% tariff on the amount of Australian beef exported to China above a quota of 200,000 tonnes starting from today. Well, around 50,000 head of cattle will be sold over the next few weeks as Victoria and South Australian weaner sales get underway. Peter Homan, Elders National Livestock Manager, predicts prices will be strong, but the season in other parts of the country may dictate the prices restockers are willing to pay.
Well, I reckon the best indicator has really been the run-up to Christmas. We've had solid prices for store cattle and all sorts of cattle, really sheep, lambs, export cattle, local cattle and store cattle. And obviously we've seen, a lot of cattle coming down from Queensland and to be processed in southern Australia.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that trend. Why are the cattle coming from the north down south?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. It wasn't that long ago that we'd be selling cattle to the Queenslanders sort of 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I think the change would be Queensland always had the dominant cattle kill. I think we've had some new plants built down here, certainly some rebuilt and bolstered. So we've probably got the best part of, three or four extra capacity abattoirs each week. So now out the kill in southern Australia is actually about 10 or 15% higher than the kill in northern Australia. That's the first time in the history of the meat game.
That's an
interesting. It's all looking good. Yeah, it's all
interesting.
Looking good.
What about the season? It's been an interesting time in Victoria. Obviously, things have really picked up in the last part of 2025. But is that playing a part at all in where the prices are at with supply and demand?
Yeah, I reckon every time we talk about someone gives their predictions of price, I think we need to say it's based on a pretty normal type season. But we've had in big parts of Victoria, we've had very limited winter rains, limited autumn rains in places, very limited autumn rains in winter too, and with some places like Western District, you know, nearly some of their lowest averages. But we've had some pretty good spring rains, so we've had less livestock to eat the feed, and it's given farmers an opportunity to harvest a lot of feed. Silage, driving around Western District, I don't think I've ever seen as much silage and bales of hay in the paddock, which is a great thing because they're really filling up empty sheds. So that's a very good thing.
So are numbers back for the weaner sales this year?
Just looking at the numbers gazetted for the main Western District sales, including the South East of South Australia, you would have to say, yeah, specifically the Western District, I reckon they'd be back 20 to 30%. So a lot are saying 20, minimum 20%. So let's work on about 25% back in total numbers, which does make a big difference.
And will that help the price at all, do you think, give it a bit of support?
It always does. I mean, if we could make one wish, we'd like to see a bit more rain in northern New South Wales, because those people usually have been strong supporters of the Victorian weaner sales. I think we'll have plenty of local support at the sales, and I think the prices will be pretty solid based on what we've seen, but it would be lovely to just, you know, get a bit of rain in northern New South Wales, because those people would be keen to buy, but at this stage they need a bit more rain before they can.
So this time last year, I mean, the prices varied obviously, but the prices for weaners fell between, let's say, 450 to about 500 cents per kilo. Where do you reckon the prices are sitting at the moment for those weaner types?
Oh, probably steers, broad brush, you know, $5 to $6. And there's been plenty of little black steers, you know, that have made their $6 plus. Forget the real little pretty ones, but there's been plenty of $6 around. Plenty of $5 to $6, depending on weight. So $5 for heavy, up to $6 for lighter, and heifers anywhere from about, you know, $3.80 to top of $4.85. So, you know, solid.
And are people in restocking mode, particularly in southern Australia?
Definitely been yes, they are restocking where they can. Bear in mind, we've had a pretty tough season, so people have just come out of a tough season, so they're not buying record numbers, but they're there to buy. So, you know, we've got price feedlot steers entering the feedlot are sort of $2,500. People that are lucky enough to finish them onto grass-fed bullocks, which is getting less and less as the feedlot market grows, probably getting $3,200 or $4,000. And, you know, cows, we're selling cows for, you know, $1,800, $2,000 a beef bred rump and loin cow. So, yeah, there's been really good trading, good buying opportunities, and anyone with grasses, there's really good trading opportunities.
And I guess the big question is, are people making profit at these levels?
Well, I think, and I might be correct, but I think everyone in the chain is there's a margin in it. I think you need to get good money for a breeder, but if you can get like $1,800 for your best, for your heavier weaners, you can obviously, feedlotters are paying $2,500 for feedlot entry. So just say that there's $1,500 average, there's $1,000 to a feedlot. And hopefully the processors, there would be less margin being made in processing space, but hopefully there's still a margin and they'll still be very competitive and they're looking to maximise production at all the plants.
The Elders National Livestock Manager, Peter Homan, speaking there with Emma Field about the weaner sales over the next few weeks in Victoria and South Australia. Big lamb sale week in Tasmania next week on tomorrow's program. We'll tell you more about that. Time now, though, to check the latest on the weather with Daniel Sherwin-Simpson from the Bureau. G'day, Daniel.
Good afternoon, Tony.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to yourself as well.
No rainfall?
No significant rainfall has been recorded in Tassie overnight. There was a couple of 0.2 showing up around, but probably that's just a little bit of dew trickling down into the gauges. We could see a little bit of rainfall today just about the southwest of the state, but not expecting anything of much significance today. And really, that's the story for the next few days. We could pick up a few light showers here or there along the east, and then sort of in the northeast. Probably on Sunday is your best chance of seeing in rainfall, but realistically, the totals won't be massive. I'm sure we'll see plenty more 0.2s and 0.4s and stuff like that over the next couple of days, Tony.
Okay, Daniel, let's unpack what we're expecting and the temperatures at the moment. What's the outlook?
Yeah, so we are sort of sitting in some more kind of milder temperatures over the next couple of days. Fairly pleasant start to the new year, but we are certainly looking to warm up a little bit as we move into tomorrow. Temperatures will generally go up 1 or 2 degrees, particularly in the southwest. You could see things a bit warmer. So most places in the high teens to low 20s, getting into the mid-20s through the Midlands and Upper Derwent Valley. But if you really want some warmer temperatures, later next week is probably where you should be looking, because as we get into sort of Tuesday, Wednesday, and possibly even Thursday next week, we could see quite a few 30s popping up across the east of the state, also through the Midlands, Tamar Valley, up around Launceston has a 30, as well as the Upper Derwent Valley. So temperatures are certainly building into next week if you want some warm summery days.
So a touch of summer. We're going to get wind with that at all, do you think?
Yeah, so it's not looking hugely windy. There is like a little bit of windy conditions about the south, but not expecting too much in terms of like significant gusty conditions. Even like strong wind warning wise, we don't have too much going on, so there's no warnings out for Tasmania. Across the coast, it's even a little bit more settled, so we're generally in a south. A southwesterly across the southern coasts, while in a southeasterly across the northern coast, elsewhere light and variable. And we're starting to see some of those afternoon sea breezes coming in. Swells are generally pretty settled as well. So really, we are in a period of settled weather, and then we will start seeing those temperatures come in next week.
All right. Details of the coastal waters and swell, Daniel?
Yeah, so out on the coast, generally, as I said, things are a little bit more settled. Out on the buoys, we have Cape Sorrel sitting around 2 metres or so at the moment. Up further around to the east at Maria Island, swells are also generally pre-settled. So we've got about 2.5 to 3 metres sitting around at Maria Island. As we look around the coast, swells generally 1.5 to 2.5 metres for the west and south, and then in the east, 1.5 to 2.5 metres in a southerly, around 1 metre in the evening for the east.
Good on you, Daniel. Thank you for that.
Cheers. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you. Daniel Sherwin-Simpson from the Bureau with the latest information for you. Coming up in just a moment, we'll see what's happening at the Taste of Summer.
Challenging chooks at your place? New year, new chook. I'm John O'Hara. Bring all your chook questions and queries for Chook Talkback from 10 a.m. Saturday on 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, the weather has certainly been terrific for the Taste of Summer so far. Stallholders are being kept busy with consumer demand. Our reporter Meg Whitfield pulled winemaker Jeremy Janeen aside on New Year's Eve to see how things were going.
It's been pretty good so far. Weather's been a little up and down, but we kind of have something for all weathers. We've got Pinot Gris Icy Poles for the warm days, and we've got cheese fondue for the cold days.
How many platters of cheese, how many wines are you expecting to serve over the course of this festival?
Ooh, that is a good question. My guess is we will do maybe not quite 1,000 cheese platters, but pretty close. And bottles of wine, I should know that off the top of my head, but well, hopefully more than we've been selling the past few days.
And talk to me a little bit about your actual wine. So you harvest grapes from two main vineyards. Can you paint a picture for people who might not be familiar?
Yeah, so we own a vineyard at the very far north of the Tamar. So we're the northernmost vineyard on the west side of the Tamar River at a little place called Yorktown, just north of Beaconsfield. And we grow Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris there, from which we make, obviously, Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris, and also sparkling and rosé. Then we lease an old vineyard just past Sorel on the Arthur Highway, which is a small vineyard, and it's got basically 40-year-old Riesling vines and 35-year-old Pinot vines. So we run that as well, and we make Riesling and another Pinot from there. But unfortunately, I've sold out of that Pinot, so I didn't bring any.
And talk to me a bit about the year in wine for you, how the vine's been going, what's the final product been like?
Well, this is a pretty challenging start to a season. It's been a very cool spring and very windy, and the vines are flowering at the moment, so this wind is not ideal. It may cause some interruptions to flowering and a slightly reduced yield, but apart from that, everything looks pretty good. We've had just enough rain. Well, at least one of my vineyards is unirrigated, so if I don't get rain, we're in a little bit of strife. But I manage four other vineyards as well, and we've been irrigating those because it has been not just dry, but the wind sort of wicks the water away from the plants as well. But the wines that we're selling now are mostly from 2023-24, and we've got a couple of 2025 wines, and all three of those seasons were pretty good to us.
With those dry conditions that we've seen the spring just past, what are you expecting that to do to the actual flavour profile of those grapes?
If you have dry seasons and the vines stress and you produce smaller berries, then particularly with the reds, the small berries mean you've got a higher proportion of skin to juice. So you get more colour, more tannin, more intense wines. But yeah, we've really got to wait and see how that pans out with the flowering and with the rest of the season. The vineyards that we irrigate, which don't go into the Haddo and Dunedin wines, those vineyards we've been irrigating for several weeks now, and so I don't think the dry will affect them terribly. The wind is the thing I'm most worried about. Like the growth this year is significantly behind last year, particularly the parts of the vineyards that are exposed to the wind are almost stunted. Like they're not growing. I mean, you can walk through the vineyard and see sort of the top of the hill where it's exposed to the wind, the shoots might be, you know, 30 or 40 centimetres tall, and beside the trees where they're sheltered from the wind, the shoots might be 75 centimetres tall.
Are there any steps you can take to kind of mitigate that, or is it just you are at the hands of the weather gods?
We're pretty much at the mercy of the weather. You can plant trees or erect like wind cloth to try and stop it, but you can't put that in every row, so yeah, that's challenging. And also, if you have trees or shade cloth beside your vines, then they get shaded, so they miss out on some of the sun. And if you plant trees, they will also compete with the vines for water. So it's, yeah, double-edged sword. But yeah, really, for the vineyards that we actually have irrigation on, keeping the water up helps a lot. And yeah, just trying to make sure that everything is in good shape, healthy, protected from disease, and yeah, but it's farming. It's
Talk to me a little bit about the actual wines that you do produce, and if you're wanting to expand into different varieties, what does that look like for you?
So with Haddo and Dunedin, we're probably not going to expand too much more than what we already do. We make wines from single sites. We grow everything that we make. We don't buy fruit from anybody else, and that's maybe slightly more difficult to do it that way, but it's quite important to me and to Nick. So we make a range of wines that are not massively different to other people, but there's a few things that we do differently. So we use native yeast from the vineyard. We don't use yeast out of a packet or cultured yeast. We don't filter our wines. We don't add any fining agents. So the only thing that any of our wines have ever seen as an additive is a little bit of sulfur as a preservative. We make a sparkling wine that is a little more challenging to make than some others. It's a really old-fashioned way of making sparkling called Méthode Ancestrale. So we pick the grapes, squeeze the juice from them, let the wild yeast from the vineyard start the fermentation in tank, and then when it gets right near the end of fermentation, we bottle it while it's still fermenting. It's a challenging way to make wine, because if you get it wrong, that's your whole vintage is gone. I guess our focus at Haddo & Dunine is largely on Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris, and yeah, I guess there's not that many people who choose to specialise in Pinot Gris. It's not the most, you know, I guess, fashionable or highbrow variety for winemakers, but we have a very special site that literally is quartzite gravel, like very lean, so produces low crops of super intense flavoured Pinot Gris. And so, yeah, we make it in barrel with a lot of stirring of the yeast in the barrel to help build texture and creaminess in the palate, and it produces a wine that, you know, we're both very proud of.
What kind of feedback have you been getting here at the taste and just broadly about those wines?
Really, really positive. I mean, there's a few people who get a bit surprised when they ask for a glass of Pinot Gris and they get something that's rich, barrel fermented, like a hint of vanilla, quite creamy, like very concentrated flavours. They're expecting something, you know, sort of fresh and light and more Sauvignon Blanc-like. But we've had a lot of people come back again and again for more glasses or more bottles. And yesterday, a couple of the yacht crews, I nearly drank us out of Riesling. they took quite a shine to that. And I'm hoping that today a few people will try and drink us out of sparkling.
That's winemaker Jeremy Dunine ending that report with Meg Whitfield at The Taste of Summer. We'll have some more stories from The Taste on tomorrow's edition of The Country Hour. Still to come today, a poor garlic growing season for one southern Tasmanian garlic grower and concern over proposed fee increases for heavy vehicles. First up, the news headlines with Meg Whitfield.
39 people were arrested in Tasmania last night as police conducted patrols at New Year's Eve festivities across the state. In the south, police helped rescue a man who fell off the Elizabeth Street pier on Hobart's waterfront in the early hours of the morning. They say he and a passerby who attempted to assist were safely rescued with no significant injuries. Police say they're happy with the overall behaviour of the Tasmanian community. Two Hobart Hurricanes have been picked in Australia's squad for the T20 Cricket World Cup. Fast bowler Nathan Ellis and big hitting batsman Tim David are part of the 15-man squad for next month's tournament in Sri Lanka and India. Mitchell Marsh will captain the side, which includes Pat Cummins, Travis Head and Glenn Maxwell. And an 8-year-old Melbourne boy has stamped the first coin of the year for 2026. Several hundred people showed up to the Royal Australian Mint in Canberra this morning for a barrel draw to select the recipients of the first 100 coins. The design marks 60 years of decimal currency in Australia.
Hello, Lucy Braden here from Drive. Happy New Year! Have you got a resolution to work on? However you go, we'll be there with you in 2026. Here on 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
Coast to coast, this is The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, garlic growers in the state have been affected by the cold weather through spring and the appearance of rust. Jeff Dugan, a garlic farmer of two decades at Coonya on the Tasman Peninsula, says his garlic crop suffered through an unusually cold spring, resulting in disappointingly small bulbs. He's told Madeleine Rajan about the troubles of rust, a pervasive fungal disease, and there are a few solid treatment solutions for.
The past couple of years, particularly in southern Tasmania, have been really, really difficult for a lot of garlic growers, primarily because of things like rust that have devastated a lot of crops, and some growers have lost entire crops to this fairly pernicious fungal disease of rust. And this season, in 2025, was particularly difficult because it was such a cool spring that we had, and that is anathema to good garlic. It really needs warmth in spring to put on weight. So again, a lot of people who manage to avoid rust have ended up with crops that the bulbs are significantly smaller than they would be otherwise.
And you talk about rust there. For someone who doesn't know what that is, can you explain? And, you know, is that to do with the colder conditions, as you mentioned there?
Yeah, there's a few things. It's a fungal disease. And it affects the foliage on garlic as well as any of the other alliums such as onion and leeks. It limits the yields you get from garlic because of its effect on the leaf. So, you know, impedes photosynthesis and bulb development. Very hard to get rid of once you've got it. Even heavy-duty commercial fungicides often prove, you know, not very effective against rust. It's airborne, and it can, you know, you can be really hygienic in your farming practice, but it can be carried, you know, quite a distance from other places. As I said, it turns the leaves yellow and then just completely shuts down photosynthesis. So it'll reduce the size of the bulb. If you pick it up early enough, you can treat it with organically. You know, I use a bicarb soda solution and vegetable oil to minimize it. Otherwise, you can mitigate a lot of its presence by spacing your garlic more than usual, so you get a good airflow between the plants. No overhead watering. Moisture, humid moisture, moist conditions really promote the growth of fungus. And a reduction of, I guess, some really highly nitrogenous fertilizers such as blood and bone or chicken manure.
And how does that impact you? I mean, how much smaller was your yield?
Yeah, I had the small yield plus rust that I just simply could not control. So it's diminished it considerably. And it makes it difficult for the following year because, you know, garlic growers tend to keep their biggest bulbs to replant to, you know, keep the crop strong. So, yeah, that personally I'll be trying to source some from other growers. But, yeah, that'll be pretty scarce this year or next year at least. I mean, garlic, if you, you know, keep it weed-free and, you know, space it well and don't overwater, you're generally pretty good. And Tasmania has one of the best climates for garlic growing because of the cold here. Often garlic's in the ground anything up to 8 months. So it develops this fantastic complexity. And given it came from areas around Afghanistan originally, wild garlic comes from there, it loves the cold.
Is there anything you would have done differently, do you think, looking back? Or you did say that it's pretty hard to avoid rust and unpredictable.
Next year I'll be spacing it more. I will be creating greater space between the plantings. Other than that, my usual practices, you know, be diligent and keep an eye out and reduce. I normally use aged chicken manure as fertilizer, but I may look at something a little different.
Where do you who do you sell your garlic to?
Well, I'm at Farmgate Market every Sunday. And so when I have enough for fresh sales, I'll sell fresh garlic. But I also do a lot of value adding with garlic. So I make a lot of products with garlic as the theme. So, yeah, I do things like make black garlic and infuse salts with garlic and pickle it and ferment it and do all sorts of things with it. It's very versatile and it really lends itself to some phenomenal uses.
I mean, it sounds like that's a good thing that you can use these smaller bulbs for sauces or other things.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Was it a particularly bad year or, you know, was it the worst you've seen?
Probably the worst I've seen in my time. So it was that unusually cold spring that I think was a critical one.
Garlic farmer Jeff Dugan there with reporter Madeline Rajan talking about the latest garlic crop. Well, truck drivers are looking at a potential further increase to heavy vehicle charges this year, making it an overall 26% increase in 5 years. The National Transport Commission is currently consulting to increase the fees by 6% in the next financial year. These fees are paid by truck and bus operators to cover the extra wear and tear on roads. However, the Australian Livestock and Rural Transporters Association Executive Director Anthony Boyle says it puts more strain on an industry already under pressure.
Well, our stance and our submission was that we've rejected their proposal. We feel we've had 6% for the last 3 years in a row, so that's 18% over 3 years and another 2.3% before that, so just over 20% in 4 years. So that would be 26% in 5 years, which is just unsustainable for our industry at the moment.
So what would a further 6% increase do to truck drivers and businesses?
Look, say it's very hard to give an average, but say for an average B double truck, your average costs are between registration and fuel taxes around $50,000 to $55,000 a year, some up to $60,000. So you're looking at around $3,000 per truck. So it's a considerable cost, particularly businesses running, 5-10 trucks, 15 to 30 grand a year in road user charging.
So this increase of the fees, it goes towards it'll change the registration fees, so increase that, and also the per litre per fuel fees, yes, as well. So that's what will impact.
That's correct. Yeah, on both. Yes.
So if we look at the consultation report from the National Transport Commission, so they've said that they estimate the heavy vehicle cost base for the last financial year was $6.3 billion, and that to ensure government fully recovers the amount spent on providing roads to heavy vehicles in the 2026-27 year, they will need the estimates that the current heavy vehicle charges would need to increase by 19% next year. So shouldn't they technically be charging more or increasing it more to cover that cost?
Well, it's a bit of smoke and mirrors with that one, because the way they work that out, they're getting cost recovery instantly. So the more money they spend on roads, the more money they're going to charge us. And even the government themselves and the NTC realise that model is flawed, and they're moving forward. There's a review next year, and we've already had discussions with them about a new model where they're working that road investment over the life of the road. So it's, instead of trying to recover it over a 7-year period, extends it over to a 50-year period, which is including maintenance, which is a far more sustainable way for us to be able to pay our way and cost recovery. At the moment, whatever they spend on roads, they're recovering that instantly, well, basically over 7 years. So all these big builds, floods, natural disasters, any extra investment in the roads, basically we're becoming the bank for it. So it's not the government who's bankrolling all these projects, it's the trucking industry.
So heavy vehicles, when we talk about these fees, it includes all vehicles with a gross vehicle mass of above 4.5 tonnes. How many trucks or businesses do you think this increase will affect?
Well, it's every truck on the road. Look, our membership alone would be probably 10,000 trucks across the country. And we would only be maybe somewhere 10-15% of the trucking industry. So, you can work that out. It's a lot.
It's a lot of people. And these fees are to help recover the damage done to roads. What are the states of the roads from the association's point of view? Have they improved?
No, and that was in our submission too. It's one thing to get the cost recovery too, but we've actually asked for a national dashboard that would actually give us visibility over the investments in the roads. We've seen things where roads get announced as election campaigns, and it could be 8 years before they even come to fruition. And funnily enough, they get re-announced at the next election that they're going to do it again. So we actually want to see a bit more transparency. We do see media releases and updates all the time of projects as they happen, but there's no monitoring and there's no actual what it cost and then, or what the budget was and what the actual return on it was either. So we've actually asked for a lot more transparency on that.
What's the current state of the trucking industry at the moment? Are people struggling?
Look, it's varied, and that's nothing unusual with the size of the country and different conditions. You look in Western Australia with the live sheep phase out over there. The trucking industry in the livestock sector has declined rapidly, and a lot of them are trying to diverse into grain, and they got a bumper harvest this year, but what we'll see will be an oversupply in the grain industry for trucks maybe in a couple of years as everyone tries to transition. South Australia had terrible drought for a while, so the stock numbers are down there. I know they're doing it pretty tough. Queensland's not going too bad, but we're about to come into some wet season, so that could change it all very quickly. So it's varied across the country, but everywhere is still struggling for staff. So the areas that are going okay still are probably struggling to keep up with staff. And then, like I said, in the other, those other states are certainly struggling for supply, and the farmers in those areas have probably done it pretty tough a little bit too. So trying to impose extra costs is a difficult thing to do when you just can't get out of the bottom line of the farmers.
So at the moment, the increase is under consultation, public consultation. When do you expect to hear a decision on this?
We expect to hear fairly soon, by the end of January. We've proposed 3%. We feel that's fair. And, you know, we're mindful of a new costing measure coming in this year, or next year, sorry, still. So we understand the government is forward-looking to do a better system on road user charging, and we're quite comfortable with what we're seeing early releases of. So our submission highlights the fact that, well, now's not the time to be jacking up high increases. Let's just, something's stable, 3% is pretty close to CPI. Most people can accept that. But another 6% on top of 6, 6, and 6, it's just starting to get ridiculous.
Australian Livestock and Rural Transport Association Executive Director Anthony Boyle speaking there to Annie Brown about the proposed 6% increase in fees by the National Transport Commission for truck and bus operators. We'll look at grain prices in just a moment.
Evenings. It was so loud.
With Helen Shields.
You'll be entertained.
Turn it into a song about a Tasmanian town.
Am I ever going to Swansea your face again?
Evenings with Helen.
Get on with it.
Returning in 2026 on 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
To the grain sector now, and barley, canola and wheat have all dropped between $11 to $15 since early December, reflecting strong supply and sluggish demand, with APW wheat sitting at around $330 a tonne and canola down to around $750. Many farmers say that is just above the cost of production. Latest US Department of Agriculture World Agricultural Report showed record crops in Australia, Argentina and Canada, and a global wheat production increase of 8.7 million tonnes. Andrew Whitelaw, grains analyst with episode3.net, says the canola fell in price a few weeks ago. Influenced by lower crude oil prices, rising global oil seed production and a bearish US soybean market. And he says there's nothing on the global horizon to improve the prospects for a wheat price rise.
No, I think we've definitely seen a further slide in prices locally in Australia, but also overseas. Probably the biggest slide has actually been in canola, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I think what we're seeing is, you know, whilst we've had the overseas falls and they're finally sort of reflecting in Australia, the other issue we've got is that, you know, New South Wales has had a pretty big crop, you know, and nationally we've probably the second largest crop on record. And what's happening now is that farmers are changing the sort of the distribution of their sales. You know, previously they would sell a little bit before harvest and around about seeding in July. Forward sales for the coming harvest, tending to hold off selling until harvest and the post-harvest period. And so you're getting this, like at the moment what we're seeing is quite a influx of sales occurring at the same time. And when you add all that onto the market at once, it becomes a bit of a buyer's market. Also at a time when the market is a little bit quieter because of the festive period, traders and buyers, they don't have that fear of missing out. They don't worry, or if we wait tomorrow, it won't be available tomorrow. They say, well, if we don't buy today, there'll be some available tomorrow.
I thought farmers were getting a bit smarter about that and holding on and having on-farm storage and things like that, but you don't think it's enough to sort of shift the dynamic?
Yes, there's still definitely a lot more grain going into silos and then being held on-farm for domestic homes, but there's only so many domestic homes. And also, on top of that, look, there's just a huge crop coming off, and that is pushing the market down, because at the end of the day, markets are driven by supply and demand, and there's a lot of supply, and that is something that is also replicated overseas. You know, we've got big crops in Canada, huge crops in Argentina.
decent crops in Russia. I said locally there's no fear of missing out, but globally there's also no fear of missing out. The grain is there and it's available for buyers to buy. But on top of that, we've also got other sort of, in this Christmas period, you know, not much happens. There's no new real news. There's no new crops getting, you know, fundamental information about them. But there is that spectre of the potential of peace in Ukraine. And we have been speaking about that for 3 years, and there's been various, you know, peace talks. But I think this is probably at the moment as close to peace as we're going to get. Whether that peace, you know, accords get signed, or whether there is a peace process, you know, I still wouldn't hold my breath, but it is as close as it has been. If peace does come, that does mean, you know, things like, whilst Ukraine has been exporting grain, it reduces all that risk premium, but it also potentially does things like reduces the price of crude oil, and the price of crude oil dropping, which already has been dropping, has a fundamentally strong impact on grain prices.
What's happening with canola? Because I thought that there was some problems getting Canadian canola to China. Are we seeing a price increase for Australian canola as a result?
No, what we've really seen is a bit of a collapse in canola prices. We've seen prices, you know, from the start of December to just now, basically, for want of a better word, get absolutely smashed and absolutely hammered. And that is largely off the back again of, you know, Canada having big crops, global demand dropping, and also, I have to point it back to again, is that crude oil price. When the crude oil prices drop, oilseed prices tend to follow because of a significant quantity of our canola and other oilseeds, which will go into biofuels. So it is not a good sign at the moment, the way the canola market has gone. However, I would say that it's still sitting above historical levels. It's still, you know, above $700 a ton for most people around the country. And also I would say as well that we are still in that, you know, purgatory period between Christmas and New Year when not a huge amount happens. So, you know, I think it's not probably the best time to be thinking about markets, and I think it's probably better just to enjoy the period. If you finished harvest, enjoy the period, and
don't think about selling
and just spend time with your friends and family.
And so it's largely the oil price that's affecting canola pricing, you think?
Oh, it's a combination of factors. You know, Canada has a huge crop as well. Around the world, oilseed crops are doing pretty well. And again, it's just that little bit of drawdown in global demand. Soybean crops in the US and the US and China trade flows have been a bit disjointed this year. When you get to about September, the rest of the world's done and it's just Australia. And Australia's had a huge crop, and also Argentina, sorry. But Argentina's also having a pretty strong crop this year.
Andrew Whitelaw, grains analyst, talking grain prices with Michael Condon there. Well, finally, today, a common complaint in the ag industry is there are not enough young people interested in the ag sector and a career in agriculture. But on a trip to Indonesia, our reporter Emma Field discovered there are many young people interested in studying agriculture and being part of its future.
I'm at a university campus at Kalitoto village in the Yogyakarta district of Indonesia. I'm at the Agrotechnology Innovation Centre of UGM, a local university with lots of research and trial plots, plus greenhouses, and plenty of ag science students.
Hello, my name is Ziza. I'm a master's student in phytopathology, UGM.
Cool. Why did you choose to study agriculture?
Actually, because my father is farmer. And then when in my society, always ask me why this plant, what the disease. So
what is the disease in the plant?
Yes, yeah. Actually. So from that, I'm interested for studying this.
Yeah, wow. And so what crops or do they grow on your farm, your father's farm?
Actually, vegetable and rice.
Rice. What do you find exciting in your studies?
Because the challenging is climate change. So I think not only climate change, but plant and disease come to more resistant. So I think we must learn new things for a solution for this problem.
Hello, my name is Uci Nugroho. I'm from Klaten, Central Java, and I master student in phytopathology UGM.
Okay. Why did you choose to study agriculture or choose to study the path that you are on?
Okay, I'm studying master in student master in phytopathology because I'm interested in in science in this
in the science.
Yes.
Yeah.
And because I'm from village.
Village.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, was your family involved in farming?
Yes.
Mm.
Karena saya tinggal di desa, jadi memang ada keluarga yang sebagai petani gitu.
Oh yes, correct. So his family lives in the village, and so some of his family members are farmer.
Okay, karena saya tinggalnya di desa ya, mbak gitu. Jadi memang
the people in the village are heavily reliant on rice. So yes, food production is very important for people, especially those who live in the village.
And what is your favorite part about your studies? What do you enjoy?
Enggak lah. Terus kemudian pertanian itu kan juga penting bagi kita, terutama bagi petani ya, karena petani itu yang dibutuhkan.
Agriculture is very important, especially for farmers.
Ya, karena itu yang selalu diaplikasikan lebih praktis, lebih mudah gitu loh.
That's what is always applied and it's more practical for them.
Dan itu
have links to technology, for example, like climate change, as what my colleague mentioned.
Yeah.
So technology helps farmers in applying all of these solutions, for example, the use of drone.
At the same campus, I meet some Japanese ag students who were there visiting the Indonesian university.
My name is Rena Sugi. My major is forestry, mainly like tree physiology.
My name is Azumi Kawai. My major is plant microbiology and especially study on Pongamia.
Yeah.
My name is Kosuke Jonouchi. I'm majoring plant microbiome too, especially in rice surface microbiome.
Yeah. And so tell me, why did you choose to study agriculture?
Actually, my hometown, grandfather and grandmother is farmer. So I want to study agriculture.
And what does your grandmother grow?
So many crops, so I difficult to explain, but mainly tomato and rice. And,
Interesting. And what about you? Why did you study agriculture?
Because there are two reasons. One is I love to eat, and so agriculture is really essential for humans, so I'm interested in. And also, I'm interested in the global warming, and I want to do something, solution.
Yeah, a solution to help with global warming.
Yeah.
And what about you? Why do you study agriculture?
I think because agriculture is connected with almost all the field of science, because it can be connected with biology, physics, and geology, or like chemistry. Yeah. So, you know, when there's some problems that can be solved by the science, agriculture can be a tackle on it for every field. So if I study this, maybe I can, you know, I can see it. Think the problem more widely view, so that's why I choose this work.
And we're here in Indonesia at a university farm. What have you learnt so far?
The species are completely different from Japanese species, like the tropical trees, tropical plants. But you know, my family name is actually meaning is Japanese cedar wood, but there's no Japanese cedar wood here.
But it turns out not everyone aspires to work in agriculture. When I travelled to Bogor, I met the son of a dairy farming couple who also value-add and make yogurt drinks on their farm.
My name is Noval. I live in Tanjung Halang.
What do you want to be when you grow up?
I want to be a president.
A president? Well, I wish you good luck with that. And when you become president, I'm going to come back and visit you in the palace.
And I will give you a free yogurt.
Good story. That was 11-year-old Nova from the Bogor region of Indonesia, wants to be a president, ending that report from Emma Field. Not a bad thing to aim for, is it? Emma travelled to Indonesia as part of the Crawford Fund Journalism Scholarship with support from DFAT and the ASEAN Australian Centre. That's our Country Hour for today. Don't forget ABC Rural Online and ABC Rural Facebook page if you want to see more of our stories. I'll put a podcast up shortly. We'll have another edition of the Country Hour after midday tomorrow.